I frequently am up here giving the talk for this reading because it follows Easter, and there's a few weeks where I don't give a sermon, so somehow this talk of entitled "How High Should We Aspire?" Often comes to me, and it always makes me chuckle a little. First, I think it's a trick question, because, you know, what are we going to say? 50%, a little bit? Of course not. You know, we're yogis, we're disciples, we're people who are really committing ourselves to going all the way. But the other thing that happens with this reading is that it happens to come for me and for many of us at a very particular moment in our year. The first part of that is that just last week was Easter. And, you know, that Easter weekend is just so extraordinarily powerful. I mean, it would be hard to find the words that would be hyperbole or exaggerating the nature of that story. I was thinking on last Friday night when we were here for Good Friday, it was so moving. The service was so moving. I will say that at the end of the service, a good percentage of people did not move from this temple for a very long time, like maybe 20 minutes, 30 minutes after it was over. So this was not just in me. But last week, and I was moved to tears up here, you know, that we do these readings and music. That's a large part of what the service is. And Asha gives a talk, and all parts of it are just deep and compelling. But in those readings, there's one of those readings where one of the guards slaps Jesus across the face. And every year when I hear that reading, it catches my breath. It just stops me where I am. First, I immediately find myself praying for that guard. I mean, can you imagine slapping God across the face? It's just, I just can hardly bear it, is what I feel. But then it's not that much later that Jesus is crucified. This all happens on Good Friday. And there he is up on the cross, and we all know this story, but every year it touches me more deeply. That this past week I said to myself, do you always forget the story because you were born and raised Jewish? And I never heard this story. But you know, I walked into Ananda in 1979, so it's a long time that I've been hearing the story. And I have to say to myself, it's not that the story is still new to me, but it's ever new. The extraordinary nature of this story is both ever new, and we're all growing, we're all expanding, we're all moving to a place where we hear the same story, or we read the same readings, but we really can hear and feel them in a different way. And I knew this is what was happening to me last week with this Good Friday story. And there is Jesus literally having been crucified. I mean, when you allow yourself, if you can bear to just feel what that means. And yet those beautiful words that come out of his mouth, "Forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do." Such a statement of love. It's almost like an unbearable amount of love. It's hard to let it in. I believe it was last week, I don't really remember, but recently Asha was focusing on a song that we do in our festival every week, Long we feared to face your love, lest our emptiness it prove. Who can bear the realization of that much love coming our way? Are we ready to accept it? Really, could we open to it? Last week, I was meeting with somebody, and they asked me a question that I've heard many times before. The question was, what if one of them is wrong? What if one of these masters is not perfect? What does that mean to all of the teachings? And it's a reasonable question for somebody to ask. But in that moment, I knew for sure that there really wasn't an answer that I could give, because the question can't be answered there. It can't be answered in a discussion. The answer can only come, of course, most of us are sitting here, and we believe that they're perfect. We know that they are avatars who descended because they love us, because if one stray brother is left behind, they'll come. And I realized I couldn't answer the question, but that hopefully that person would be able to have an experience that would touch their heart. Because for me, the harder question, in a way, the more important question is, what if they are perfect? What if we're right and they're perfect? Very much like trying to receive Christ's love. We are here trying to receive these masters' love and their wisdom and their perfection. It's why they came. They want us to have it. And it sounds like, great, let's go for it. And of course we are, but it's challenging. Swamiji himself says, we are born with a predisposition to superficiality. Those were his words. He says, just think of it. You come into this body, you have to learn so much about your body, how to sit up, how to crawl, how to walk, eventually how to run, if you just think of using your body, how to balance it. You have to develop a language. You have to feed it, clothe it, take care of it. He said everything about life draws us out to our senses. And he said, really, the path to God is like an obstacle course. He didn't even say it's like an obstacle course. He said it is an obstacle course. And that's the truth. So we're talking about how high should we aspire? Well, we want to receive that love. Not easy, but we have to keep holding that our goal is to live in terms of our soul's understanding of truth and not to let ourselves get lazy, be deluded, rest in this sense of what our ego wants to tell us. Because the ego is the real limitation to everything that we want. There's a cartoon that I saw, which I've shared in the past, but I can't help it. As I said, I come to this reading every year. And on the first picture of this cartoon, there's a canary in a cage, and it has its little claws and its wings wrapped around these two bars, and it's staring out. And you look at that and you think, oh, that poor guy, he wants to be free. But in the second caption, where they back up and they show you the bigger picture, the only two bars there are the bars that he's holding on to. Everything else is wide open. And it's very poignant, because it's our story. We're so free, but we don't see it because of this dis-ease of the ego, which holds us here and has us believing that we're limited to what we perceive, these two bars in front of us. There's another story that I heard some time ago. This is a true story now about a young man who as a teenager developed juvenile onset diabetes. And juvenile onset diabetes is a very difficult condition for people to get. It just, you can imagine as a teenager, as a young child, when all you want to be doing is being with your friends and eating pizza and ice cream and junk food and whatever people want to do. It's a very limiting disease for youngsters. And it very often leads to deep emotional issues for people. I've just seen it many times. Kids wind up rebelling, acting out about it, overeating, putting themselves in and out of diabetic comas. They don't take their insulin. This young man, David, had juvenile onset diabetes. And he was in the midst of doing all that, and he was, in fact, at his parents' insistence, seeing a therapist. And the therapist actually wrote this story. One night, David had a dream. And the dream was that he was sitting in a big open room that didn't have a ceiling. And in that room was a statue of Buddha. And he was just staring at this statue of Buddha when suddenly from behind him comes an arrow, a dagger, and it goes right into the heart of the Buddha. And he gasps. He was feeling very peaceful. And he's staring at the heart of Buddha with this dagger in it. When all of a sudden, this is his dream, remember, the Buddha starts growing. And it grows and it grows and it grows until it's several stories tall. And suddenly, this thing that was a dagger in the heart of Buddha is just this tiny little dot, almost unnoticeable. And he awakens from his dream, realizing that whatever it is that is happening to him in life, if he can expand his awareness and his consciousness, that it becomes a barely noticeable dot rather than the very center of all that is. If he can live in that consciousness that's several stories tall, that goes to infinity, everything that we hold as being difficult and confining, we see from the eyes of the divine that is not that at all. We're looking to live from a soul perspective of our souls, not from the perspective of the ego. Because again, the ego is riddled with that dis-ease that tells us that the ability, that the ego's ability to perceive things is the limit of all there is to be perceived. And of course, it's not at all true. The second part of why this timing is always so poignant for me is because it comes right on the heels of our finishing our Raja Yoga class. Raja Yoga, for those of you that don't know, is, we've turned it, it was a 14-step teaching that Swamiji wrote many years ago. And it's all of the teachings of what it means to be a yogi. We've expanded it to 16 weeks. So now we're together for 4 months, and we do this intensive study. And last week was the last class of 16 weeks. And I think, again, because we've all taught it a lot, we've heard it a lot, we're all growing spiritually, I had a new understanding last week of how to present the final class. And the final class is called The Yogic Scheme of Life. And Swamiji, first of all, he starts it with a wonderful story, which I'll repeat. Forgive me, those of you who are just in Raja Yoga. But he tells a story of a man who's out on a boat fishing, and he has his dog in the boat. And he shoots a bird, and he says to the dog, go get the bird. And the dog jumps out of the boat, and he runs across the water, and he gets the bird, and he brings it back. And the guy goes, am I hallucinating? My dog just walked on water. So he's not sure what's going on, so he shoots another bird. And then he says to the dog, go fetch the bird. So the dog runs across the water, and he gets the bird. And the next day, he's so sure that something's wrong with his mind. The next day, he brings a friend, and he says to the friend, watch this. And he shoots a bird, and the dog runs on the water and brings the bird back. And the man's just not, he watches it and doesn't react. So this man does it one more time. And when his friend doesn't react again, he says to him, what's wrong with you? Did you just see what my dog did? Did you just see what happened? And the guy goes, yeah, I saw it. Stupid dog hasn't learned how to swim. It's an absolutely brilliant story, which speaks to so much of what Swamiji keeps coming back to in Raja Yoga. We live in terms of our logical mind, our ego, so much so that when we see a dog running on water, literally walking on water, there's just no way to let it in. That didn't happen. Stupid thing can't swim. What's wrong with it? Not, wow, miracles happen. Look at what's going on. But this last chapter, The Yogic Scheme of Life, Swamiji says, I'm going to pick this up by the thread of superconsciousness. Now, but what he's done and what came to me that day is that Swamiji has painted, he's drawn a picture in Raja Yoga, and he has explained it to us with extraordinary clarity, the descent of the soul leaving its home in God, and then the journey that it has to take to come back. And in chapter 2 of Raja Yoga, he starts laying it out, and he says, this is what you need to do to get back to soul consciousness, to live where, as he says in this reading, it's not good enough for you guys to just do better than the Pharisees. What does that mean? What kind of accomplishment is that? You are here. We are all here to develop the awareness and live with the awareness that we already are the divine, the very definition of self-realization, which is what this path is, the knowing in every part of body, mind, and soul, that we are already in the possession of the kingdom of God, that God's omnipresence is our omnipresence. We don't have to ask to learn anything. At the end of that, all we need to do is increase our knowing. So Swamiji has taken these 14 lessons. He says in chapter 2, here's all the different paths you can take. Here's Patanjali, what he's taught you. Here's every stage you're going to need to go through. You're nothing but pure energy. Here's why that's important. Because the greater the flow of energy, the greater the magnetism. The greater the magnetism, the more you can magnetize your guru's love. He very delightfully starts out the chapter on the guru. First sentence, chapter of the guru, you need one. That's what he says, period. He says, don't think you can do this on your own. And he walks us so clearly, really, it's gotten to be clearly after we've read it so many times and we've grown to where we are. This is where you're going. Chapter 14, the yogic scheme of life. This is what you're all doing. You've left this Shankhya phase. You've entered this yogic phase. You want to know how to get to this place that we're talking about in the reading. This is it. And nothing short of this will satisfy you. And you have to find ways to believe this. I had an experience with Swamiji many years ago now. And another story that I've told, but that's why these great stories happen to us. They're just worth telling and retelling. Swamiji was very, very, he was in our community one time. And he actually came down because we were doing, well, we were probably doing some great event out in the lawn because he came. But he was there and he was going to be speaking to us. And he got very sick, really very sick. I was just hearing about it. He was upstairs in a bedroom in Asha's home. And I kept wondering, should I offer to go and see Swamiji? Because, you know, I'm a doctor, maybe I had something to offer. So I asked Asha, should I go up there? And she said, let me ask him. And she came down and she said, yes, he'd like you to come up and see him. So I go up there, and he was really literally burning up. He was on fire with a fever. And I said to him, Swamiji, the first thing we have to do is bring your temperature down. I said, so what I'd like to do is to have a couple of us get cool rags. We'll put them on the back of your neck and all around your head. And I said, how does that sound? And he sat there for a minute, and then he said, ghastly, utterly ghastly. So I said to him, you know, this is my teacher, my guru. He's telling me that sounds pretty horrible. I said, well, may we do it anyway? Silence, if you must. So we did. We put these cool cloths, you know, I didn't want to just put them everywhere because then people shiver and your body temperature goes back up when you shiver. So we just had his head wrapped in his neck. And sure enough, his fever came down, but he was sick. And I think he wound up having a pneumonia that time too. I'm not really sure, but he was very sick. So I, out of the goodness of my heart, wanted to tell him that he didn't have to come and give the talk. Because I couldn't imagine, it was beyond comprehension to me, that he was going to get out of that bed and come downstairs and give a talk. But I had heard stories before of when people said to him, don't, it's okay. He didn't like that. So I said to him, you know, Swamiji, if you felt it would be better not to give the talk, or that you just didn't feel up to it, we would be fine. I said to him, we would be perfectly fine with it. He looked at me with such power. He said to me, Shanti, I can't give this talk, but God can and he will. Just like that. I mean, what a poignant lesson. I feel like I'm still learning. I mean, of course I'm still learning. Let me just rescind that whole last sentence. But I feel like I'm still learning from that moment that he gave me. God is the doer. Everything is God. None of us could be doing any of what we're doing if it wasn't for God. But just like that, he went outside, he gave the talk, and this is the truth. If you hadn't have been up in that bedroom with him, you would have never known that he was sick. He spoke for over a half hour, then he went back up in bed and got sick again. I mean, it was just such a moment of teaching. Anyway, I'll share one more thing with you. I had a dream last night. And it was all dreams can be a little strange, but I was in my bedroom, I was, but in the dream I was. And all of a sudden I wake up and I realize that a lot of the young people from the church are there. Navashan was there, Sai Ganesh, Tandava. They're in my bedroom. It really confused me. It was dark and I was trying to focus in on them, but I couldn't quite. And then they were trying to let me know something. And then I became aware that they were saying to me, people were going to come and search my home. And somehow, don't ask me what this is about, I knew that people had brought bundles of clothes and other things into my house that had little packets of drugs in them, like cocaine, methamphetamine, you know, opiates. I knew they were hidden in my house. But in my dream, I couldn't do anything about it. I kept feeling foggy. I couldn't think right. But here were these law people. I don't know who they were. They weren't policemen, but maybe they were drug enforcement policemen. And it was very clear that they were trying to get me. But I knew I don't use drugs, and those were not my drugs, but they were in my house, and Navashan and Sai Ganesh and Tandava were watching, but none of us could do anything. And all of a sudden, after, I have no idea how long the dream went on, it was horrifying to me. A dream where you want to do something you can't. I felt absolutely trapped in the worst way. And then I said to myself, Shanti, call on Master, you know, in my dream. So I started praying as hard as I could. I mean, really fervent prayers. And then every time these drug people would go to touch a place where there was a drug, a great light would come out of it. And it happened about 10 times. And then I woke up. It was, I don't know if it was exactly a super conscious dream, but it really just shares again that very simple message. We have to remember to call on God. We are helpless. I felt helpless in this dream. And my three friends, and you know, I'll say this to you in an odd way. I don't know what it's, it's got to be about age, but it's just about my relationship with them too. I mean, I love these three. Everybody knows that. But I rely on them in a way. Sometimes I just look at one of them and they'll know what I need and they'll do it. I mean, in real life, a lot. But in my dream, they couldn't help me. You know, and we were just all, I don't know what they were feeling, but it was such a sense of powerlessness. Because we are powerless until we bring God into it. And the instant we bring God into it, there's just light. And when I woke up this morning, I said to myself, when we call on God, when we remember God, God is what we need. That's what we need to be aspiring to. That's what we can never forget. Because he doesn't just come outside of us and make little lights appear and make the bad guys go away. He gets into this astral spine. This is what Swamiji is teaching us in Raja Yoga. He transforms us from the inside out. He changes the very energy that we are so that what is manifested from us becomes completely different. It changes everything about us. As soon as we remember to open our hearts and let that divine force enter and take charge of our lives, to do exactly what Swamiji said, with more energy, with more willpower, raising our magnetism, finding our guru, constantly calling on him. The next chapters, I mean, affirmations, you know, till he gets back, he gets us back to spiritual anatomy, the astral spine. And of course he holds that closest to the yogic scheme of life, because we're out here, and he's just brought us back through this whole wonderful teaching in 14 beautiful steps up through the chakras, up through the astral spine, right back up to here at one with him. All we need to do is improve our knowing, right? We are already in possession of the kingdom of God. All we need to do is improve our knowing.
From the depths of slumber as I ascend, the spiral stairways of wakefulness, I will whisper, whisper, God, God, God. Thou art the food, and when I break my fast of nightly separation from thee, I will taste thee and mentally say, God, God, God. No matter where I go, the spotlight of my mind will ever keep turning on thee, and in the battle din of activity, my silent war cry will be, God, God, God. When boisterous storms of trials shriek, and when worries howl at me, I will drown their noises loudly chanting, God, God. Every night in time of deepest sleep, when peace dreams and calls joy, joy, my joy comes singing evermore, God, God, God. Dreams with threads of memories, on that magic cloth will I emboss, God, God, God. Eating, working, dreaming, sleeping, serving, meditating, chanting, divinely loving, my soul will constantly hum, unheard by any. God, God. God.